Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to this very special edition of the Empire Podcast, dedicated to arguably the greatest filmmaking duo in the history of British cinema. No, it's not Ant and Dec. They only made one film. Masterpiece, though it is, Alien Autopsy doesn't qualify them for special podcast status. I'm talking instead about Powell and Pressburger. Oh, yes, indeed, Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, whose work is being celebrated right now as we speak in a colossal and amazing BFI retrospective that spans the length and breadth of the country. It is called Cinema Unbound, The Creative Worlds of Powell and Pressburger. And joining me to discuss Powell and Pressburger over the next half hour, 45 minutes or so, are three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Ian Freer is here.
Hello, Chris.
How are you, Ian?
I'm good, man. I'm going to go down to the BFI exhibition and try on those red shoes.
Really?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I'll look great in those. They won't cart me out or put me in prison or anything, will they?
No, they won't. They won't.
Ian, I think it's great that you've come dressed as a nun. I think that's real dedication to
with the red lipstick.
Yeah.
I know where I'm going. I'm going next to Nick Dissemblian, who is also here. Hello, Nick.
Hello. Very happy to be part of this powwow.
Powwowl.
Pleasure to be here.
This is the highbrow stuff. You wouldn't get the sort of lowbrow humor on an Ant and Dec retrospective, would you, Ian?
We're moments away from who's going to win a fight between Powell and Pressburger.
That is my third question.
My money's on Emmerich.
Roland Emmerich Pressburger would definitely win this one.
No, when Michael Powell is from Kent. He absolutely have him.
He'll fuck you up, mate.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Speaking of people who'll cut you, it's John Nugent.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Right.
I don't do the segues, John. They just present themselves to me. So what can I do?
Yes, I will cut you. No, I won't.
That's the most middle-class threat I've ever heard.
If it's all right with you, I might
if you
slash
just,
you up.
Just a little nick. Just a little nick here and there. But listen, before you guys talk about Powell and Pressburger, let's hear from two giants of filmmaking who are connected in interesting personal ways to Powell and Pressburger. You have Thelma Schoonmaker, who is, of course, Martin Scorsese's legendary editor and was married to Michael Powell. And then you also have Kevin MacDonald, the Scottish film director, who is Emmerich Pressburger's grandson. Now, John here had the great privilege of talking to them both together in the BFI. Where was it, John? Where were we? The drawing room?
The drawing room, yeah.
The drawing room.
Yeah.
It was John Nugent in the BFI drawing room with the microphone.
That's the most middle-class thing in the history of the world, isn't it? John Nugent.
I mean,
BFI drawing room.
I was happy to lean into it. It was like, what a treat. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, we only
spoke. Waitrose broke out at one point.
That's right. Yes. John. We swapped tips on organic.
I liked picnic lunch.
The first 5 minutes of this interview are all about kale. Not Pauline kale, just kale. It's really weird. Anyway, they were great, weren't they?
No,
I was in the room as well.
It was really wonderful. I mean, yeah, they like we only spoke for, I don't know, 20, 25 minutes, but I could have spoken to them for hours and hours. And before we even were recording, they were just, you know, they're both sort of custodians of the legacy of Powell and Pressburger. So they've spent a lot of time together and they could speak for hours and hours on this subject.
Legacy, but not the legacy, which is my fourth question. If you had to build a Lego set from any of Alan Pressburger's movies.
Oh, great.
All right, so who'd win in a fight?
Yeah.
And what Lego set?
A Lancaster bomber from A Matter of Life and Death with a little David Niven and a little Kim Hunter and a whole building control tower and all that kind of thing. So I'd do Matter of Life and Death. No, I wouldn't. I've changed my mind. I'm going to do Black Narcissus and Nunnery.
I'd do the cathedral from Canterbury Tale, and then the glue man would come and just fuck it all up.
They don't get this shit on the Sight and Sound podcast.
Tell you that, Sight and Sound.
Yeah. Some white Legos, Nick. Are they black and white Legos?
Probably.
You can have any color you want, Ian.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
There are no boundaries to Lego.
Okay.
It's all good. John, who would you go for?
I don't know. Maybe I know where I'm going because I watched that recently. You could have some, like, I don't know.
An Angus cow.
Yeah.
What about the staircase from...
The staircase from Matter of Life and Death would be a good one, actually.
Yeah, that would take ages.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because in theory it's infinite, right? So, I mean, oh God, infinite pieces, infinite time, infinite terror, like Event Horizon. A film I think that Powell and Pressburger would have loved. No, anyway, here's Thelma Schoonmaker and Kevin MacDonald. Do please enjoy.
We're thrilled and honoured to have Thelma Schoonmaker and Kevin McDonald on the Empire podcast. How are you both?
Great.
Good. She has a cold, though. Is she not great?
But I guess the reason we're all talking today is because of Paul and Pressburger, because of course the BFI are doing a fantastic retrospective of their work, Cinema Unbound, which starts today, I believe, with The Matter of Life.
That's
and
right.
Death.
Yeah, tonight.
Which are you introducing that, Kevin?
Thelma and I are introducing.
You're
it.
Both introducing
I'm hoping
it.
Thelma's. Oh, she knows more than I do, and she's going to have more to say.
No, not really. But it was Powell's favorite film.
Yes.
And Emmerich Pressburger's favorite film was Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which is
okay.
My favorite film. So,
which is going to be showing in a few weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the reason that Michael Powell loved the film so much is that he could become a magician and really do anything, create heaven and earth, stop time, shoot in black and white and color, and do all kinds of wonderful magical things throughout the film. But he wanted to make it actually also very true medically. So he studied a lot of texts about the damage that people's, incur during warfare.
Yeah.
And his brother-in-law was also a surgeon who was working with wounded men. So he came up with this way of dealing with it medically, which he preferred to the original version of the script, which was more ghostly. But that reality is part of what makes it work so much, I think.
Yeah.
I funnily enough, I was just in Hungary a few weeks ago, where they were showing a few Paul Pressburger films, and they showed this one. And I mentioned that I had heard somewhere that it was based on a Hungarian book, or inspired by a Hungarian book called A Journey Round My Skull.
Oh, wow.
Which was written by a famous Hungarian author called, I'm going to mispronounce this horribly, Frigyes Karinthy.
Okay.
And this book, he was apparently a very famous literary figure in Hungary in the 20s and 30s. And he had, sometime in the late 30s, he started having hallucinations. And anyway, I didn't know much about it, but then I mentioned this in the introduction of the film. Somebody came up to me after and said, oh, that's a very famous book here, and started to tell me more about it. And it is sort of a novelized version of his medical treatment. This author started having these hallucinations. He goes to a doctor. He starts to find the medical rationale behind his hallucinations. So I think that's where the sort of very first idea must have come from.
Yes, and actually the whole film is kind of a hallucination, if you think about it. And yeah. the one of the things that people should watch for is that the optical effects in this movie are amazing. And for example, the first shot, this is the universe. Big, isn't it?
It's, yes.
It's an amazing optical. I really want to find out how the hell they did that without digital.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine how they did that. But
it's better than it would be digital because it looks more real.
That's right.
Yeah.
It does. And, when the one thing that's slightly odd about it is that the earth is all moss colored, covered and colored. That's because it's made in Britain where everything is nice and green. But when Arthur Clarke wrote 2001, first saw the first photo taken from a satellite of the earth, he was astounded at the rich blue because there's so much water.
Yeah.
But anyway, the reason the visual effects are so good is that Papa Day, as he was called, was the visual effects expert, and he had studied under Georges Méliès.
Wow!
And his stuff in Thief of Baghdad and all kinds of movies is extraordinary. And George Lucas was so impressed by what he saw that he came to England and brought back some of the people who actually made these effects, and they worked on Star Wars.
Wow.
For quite a while, actually. So it's really interesting that we've gone now with the restorations, which are done digitally, we've gone from Méliès to Papa Day to Powell and Pressburger to George Lucas.
Yeah.
And now with these restorations, we're back to Powell and Pressburger again. And George Lucas is funding some of them.
Yes, of course, with the Film Foundation.
Through Scorsese's Film Foundation, which has restored 500 films around the world.
Wow. It is an incredible cinematic legacy, isn't it? I mean, A Matter of Life and Death, I think, is it's probably my favorite film of all time. I'm completely obsessed with it. It's
so wonderful.
So beautiful.
it is extraordinary that so talking about the special effects, that obviously this famous staircase shot.
Yeah.
The number of films I see where they've kind of paid homage or stolen that idea. And I was recently watching Soul, the Disney film with my kids, and it's got the staircase.
Really?
It's got all sorts of little homages to the film. You should watch it. It's actually a pretty good film.
It's got kind of like a hole in the heaven that you look down on Earth.
You look down on Earth. It's exactly like that section. Yeah. But it's done very knowingly, and it's lovely, actually.
Well, I think Greta Gerwig said that A Matter of Life and Death was a big influence on her
because of the
imagination.
Yeah.
On Barbie, my God.
There you go. So what's happening now is that Barbie fans know about that movie.
Yes.
And maybe they're watching it.
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it?
Do your friends know about Paul and Pressburger?
Some of them do, yeah. I mean, probably most of them because I've been bleating on to them for years trying to get them to watch all of them. So,
are they coming across at all?
I think so, yeah. I think a few people are coming to see The Red Shoes with me. So, yeah, do you feel like a lot of young people are more interested in
films? I've been told and feel, yes.
Yeah.
I think also directors like Wes Anderson, who's spoken quite a lot about his love.
Yeah.
And you can see the kind of influence of some Paul Pressburger elements in his film, in the design and that kind of thing.
Yes.
And I feel like that we've come full circle from the days when, because I was looking actually before I came here today at some of the reviews for A Matter of Life and Death. I don't know if you've looked at them recently, but they're kind of amazing because they're extremely mixed. In fact, I would say mixed negative. In the parlance of the film business, they're sort of like, there's a lot of them say this is they had this great idea. Why did they make such a vulgar film? Why is it not more realistic? Yeah. A real British film is a realistic film. One of them says, and so it's. I mean, there are people who say this is their best film yet. It's a technical masterpiece. People say, but there's a sort of misunderstanding about what the film
is. Actually, in the documentary we're making, we mentioned that Small Back Room was more realistic, so people liked that, or the critics did. Mm. But with these reviews you're reading, are they from?
They were from
the
Variety, Screen Daily, whatever.
But are they recent? Are there more?
Oh, no. These are the 40s ones.
Really? Mm.
These are the 40s. And then there's somebody who says because we forget today that the Royal Command film performance was a big, this was the first film which ever had that. And obviously today that's it's nothing really. I don't want to say it's nothing, but it's not what it was. But then it was just after the war. So it was a celebration of peace. It's like, 8 months after the end of the war or something. It's on the big, one of the few big celebrity get-togethers there had been. The king and queen came, apparently their car was almost overturned by the crowd. And, and there was 50,000 people outside the cinema. Huge excitement. 20 or 30 guineas a ticket. That must be like £1,000 or something, or £500 in today's. I mean, it's a lot of money.
Oh, because but anyway, it was a charity.
Charity thing, yeah. Then there were people in the press saying, oh, this movie, why have they chosen this film? It's not a deserving British film.
Wow.
So it's really amazing. It's one of the things that's most incredible, isn't it, about Palm Pressburger, how the perception of the films critically has shifted so radically.
Yes. Well, I don't think they were ever, they were commercially successful except for A Canterbury Tale, but they were never praised by the press. Yes. Mm. And then when the Kitchen Sink School came in, then people said, oh, let's get rid of them. They're colonial, they're old fashioned, and how wrong they were.
Yeah. It's true, isn't it? The critical community has never it took them a very long time to appreciate the importance of these films. I mean, it was only Michael Powell who made Peeping Tom, but that was quite a turning point in their reputation, I suppose, wasn't it?
Really, they were just thrown out like the baby with the bathwater. It was really horrendous. But it's interesting, some of the films made after the war are not holding up as well. Mm. These films are sustaining, which is extraordinary. That's why young people are reacting to them today. I mean, it's quite amazing because they're about humanity and they're about the whole world. Michael Powell said, we shouldn't be making films for the UK. We should make films for the world.
Yeah.
And in the days of silent films, you could send a film to Japan. They would take out the American or the English titles, put in Japanese ones. It was the same film. And you could send a film anywhere, to Peru, and people could see it. And when sound came in, then that meant translation, subtitles, and everything stopped. It didn't become so worldwide, but they, in their minds, were making films for the world. Yeah. That's why you sometimes hear German or French. It's never subtitled because they want you to get the flavor of it. And they also, Michael said, you should always be ahead of your audience. Don't ever talk down to them. Don't explain. Make sure you're ahead of them because they're ahead of you. So that was great advice to Scorsese and me.
Yeah.
Don't explain and stay ahead of your audience.
Yeah.
And I guess it worked, right? Because, I mean, these films have endured for so long and
people are,
you know, this BFI season are packed screens every night.
That's right. So it does have something to do with that overall nature of the films they made, the humanity in them.
I think the humanity is the thing that I would pinpoint as well, because I think it's this, the most obvious example of that is the way that German characters are treated in the films.
Yes.
You know, they're making these, they're great films during the war, and shortly after the war, when the general, you know, public perception and understandably of the Germans was that they were, you know, unspeakable, evil, horrendous, you know, murderers.
Mm.
And yet consistently they have the complexity of, yes, there are bad German characters, but there are also decent German characters. And there's a real determination to see the difference between Nazis and Germans.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, means that they don't just play as propaganda films. They play as films about human beings in particular historical situations.
It's so true. And it was Emmerich's friendship and with many Germans when he was working there that made him understand that you can't just criminalize, you know, all these people. And that's why. And then, of course, Anton was a huge, blessing for them. Such a great actor. Austrian German, and he gave so much, and it's absolutely critical that they were able to do this in the middle of the Blitz.
Yes,
a friendship between a German and an Englishman.
So many of their other collaborators were German as well, or Eastern European. One with Alan Gray, the composer of A Matter of Life and Death.
Mm-hmm.
I can't pronounce his original name. It's something.
No, Alfred Junge.
Alfred Junge, of course.
Hein Heckroth.
Hein Heckroth. Yeah, they're all either German or Eastern European. And
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were the best craftspeople around. And they all collaborated together in this really beautiful United Nations kind of way.
And you know, one of the things is that Emmerich Pressburger was considered an enemy alien because he came from Hitler's Germany. He left later than some others, and he was forced to go to the police station once a week. Is that right?
I think it's sometimes once a day.
Once a day.
Yeah.
And he had a curfew at night. So you'll see it tonight in his choice for a clip, which is the speech that Anton Volbruch makes about what it's like to be a refugee. Hein Heckroth, the great designer of the Red Shoes and many other things, was considered an enemy alien. His wife was Jewish. That's why he left Germany. He was not Jewish himself. And so he was sent with a bunch of enemy aliens to Australia for 2 years. And on the way there, they discovered that one of the enemy aliens was a Nazi. So they threw him overboard.
Wow.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
Blimey.
Can you imagine these great artists being considered enemy aliens? You think it was once a day?
I think he had to go once a day, certainly at the beginning of the war, I think maybe later on. And he couldn't leave London without special written permission and all of this sort of stuff. So you were being treated as a suspicious person.
Yes.
He was very lucky, though, actually, that he didn't get sent to Australia or Canada or the Isle of Man. These people got sent to. So he, you know, he managed to get an exception in a way.
Yes.
To be able to carry
maybe
on working.
Korda,
probably through Alexander Korda, who was such good friends with Churchill, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But
that was lucky. But I mean, it's insane for them to be treated this way. And
so, but all the way through the war, and I think that explains so much about the kind of, when you understand that that's the situation that these films are being made under, the intensity of them and the sort of the passion of them, and the fact that they really are trying to change your mind. They're trying to change the way that you see the world through these films.
Mm. Yeah.
Open your mind. Yes.
I'm curious, because we should explain for listeners who don't know that, obviously, Thelma, you were married to Michael Powell and Kevin Emmerich was your granddad.
Yeah.
What were they like as people? what are your memories of them?
Well, obviously, I only knew Emmerich when he was already pretty old.
Yeah.
He died when I was 21. And he lived in Suffolk in a tiny little thatched house called Shoemaker's Cottage.
Great.
Which was a subject of some jokes between Michael, when Michael met Thelma. Mm. Her name sounds a little bit like Shoemaker. that was a subject of some jokes between them. But he lived in this tiny little house. Michael lived on the other side of London, or the equivalent distance from London the other way, in the Cotswolds, and also in a tiny little cottage. And they both were kind of these forgotten figures in the 1970s when I got to know Emmerich, and later a little bit Michael. And they were, you know, both still passionate about film, wanting to write, wanting to direct, wanting, you know, but nobody would listen to them. And it was only in the mid-70s there was the first retrospective here at the BFI, which I think Kevin Goff Yates organized.
Yeah, and Ian Christie.
Yes, and Ian Christie. And that was the beginning of people recognizing them. But also it was thanks to Martin Scorsese and Francis Coppola a little bit later, and these figures who recognized these great American, you know, the new generation in the 70s American cinema recognized the genius that, you know, Michael and Emmerich were rediscovered. And so within his lifetime, and within my memory, I remember Emmerich going to Cannes to have a retrospective there, and various New York, to the Museum of Modern Art. And the joy, I think, for both of them in living long enough to see your work recognized. Oh, it wasn't a waste of time. It hasn't been forgotten. Actually, people love this. And so, you know, Emmerich really had in some ways a kind of great last few years. He was quite a lonely person, and you know, a lot of his family died in the Holocaust, and so there was a lot of sadness, I think, around that for him.
Yeah.
But he was quite secretive and didn't really discuss that too much.
Yeah.
But could you talk about how he fed you?
Thelma's referring to the fact that every time I used to go and see him, my brother and I used to go as sort of young, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old. We'd take the train from Scotland, where I lived, out to Ipswich, where he would pick us up in his Karmann Ghia, take us to his tiny cottage, and he would have spent, you know, 3 days cooking this Hungarian feast that would basically last all weekend with, like, you know, pork chops as, you know, as thick as your arm. Chestnut puree with cream and huge piles, boiled tongue, other disgusting things. That I wouldn't really bear. But and then he'd give us Pilsner Urquell, his favorite beer from the Czech Republic, which he used to actually have to. That was before Pilsner Urquell was, you know, commonly imported in the UK. He would get it imported specially from Czech Republic. I don't know how you did that during the Cold War, but he did it. And we, you know, even as sort of 11, 12 year olds, we'd have a glass of beer with our lunch and just be knocked out for the rest of the time. But I remember that he, you know, there was very sweet side to him, and he loved animals. And the older he got, he'd grown up in the countryside, he'd grown up with farm animals, and he would feed the birds, feed the fish. And even I remember towards the end, I went to the house and there were these little bottle caps all around the house filled with water everywhere. And I said, "What? Why have you got bottle caps filled with water?" He said, "Oh, so that the spiders have something to drink," he said.
That's lovely. That's
lovely. See, and one of the final shots we have in, because we don't have enough coverage of Emmerich in the documentary we're making, is him feeding the fish.
Yes. He just loved it. He loved all those animals, yeah.
But my stepson, Michael Powell's son, Columba Powell, when I make chocolate mousse, he says, you know, I say, "Well, how is it?" And he says, "Well, it's good, but it's not like Emmerich's." Uh-huh. And I keep asking Andrew, his older brother, for the recipe so I can finally make Emmerich's.
Well, I remember famously when he used to come and stay with us sometimes for Christmas, he would send in advance his order of food that he wanted, and it would be, you know, 4 dozen eggs, mostly to make chocolate mousse.
Yeah.
So basically that's the secret is a ton of eggs, a ton of cream.
So even when he came to your house in Scotland, he cooked there.
He'd cook, yeah. He loved to cook. I guess that's the connection he still had with Hungary, was through the cuisine.
Don't you think it was also that he was starving when he first went to Germany?
Yes.
And so Michael said he was never without a salami in his salami and what would it be? Whiskey? No.
No, salami and probably vodka? Some palinka, which is the kind of spirit that they drink made out of apricot brandy. Yeah. So he spent 2 or 3 years in Germany living as a tramp, living on the streets before he got his first writing published in newspapers. So he really knew what hunger was. He knew what hardship was.
And he was determined not to have that happen again.
Yeah.
Michael Powell was also a wonderful cook, a fantastic cook.
Yeah.
And I wonder why they were both. That's really interesting.
They're both fascinated by food. Michael, presumably because of his young adulthood in France. They fell in love with food, didn't
they? Maybe, yeah. But anyway, Michael was, I think the thing about the two of them, as Kevin has already said, is that they didn't become bitter. And I don't know many filmmakers who would not have become bitter with what they went through, particularly Michael with Peeping Tom. But Michael just kept on dreaming of projects. He wrote almost 100 projects or dreamed up 100 projects after the collapse of the careers, and just kept writing every day. And then when I was with him, he was writing his autobiography, and I was helping him edit it and get it published. But he was he had a great love of life. Every little thing in the day meant something to him. The light on the chestnut trees outside, or he just cherished every second of every day, and I've never been around someone like that.
Yeah,
that was wonderful to live with. I can't tell you.
Oh, that's so lovely. I mean, I honestly could hear you speak about these two for hours. It's been such a pleasure. I think that's all the time we have. But
Thelma and Kevin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. That was really fun.
Okay, that was Thelma Schoonmaker and Kevin MacDonald. John, who was your favourite? Which one did you like best?
I'm not going to answer that.
Damn it, I thought I could get him. Ian, obviously you're much older than everyone else here. I imagine you were exposed to PMP, not postage and packaging, but Pal and Pressburger at a very early age when you were just a wee nipper.
Yeah, so I discovered, like most people, I discovered Pal and Pressburger through Martin Scorsese. This is in the early 80s. Also at that time, Michael Powell was collaborating with Francis Coppola on One from the Heart. He was an advisor at American Zoetrope. So he was in the kind of the orbit of my heroes. So that's how I come to know him. I think the first film of his I saw was Peeping Tom. So not a Powell and Pressburger film. Pressburger wasn't involved in that. And everything you read was about the influence of Powell on Scorsese. So the Reds in Mean Streets Bar, a Nick's directly from Powell and Pressburger. So that was kind of my route into him.
All right. John, what about you?
I remember exactly where I was when I first came. I think I was vaguely aware of Powell and Pressburger, but the first time I saw one of their films, I was 18 years old and I was studying film studies at university and I did a module on British film. And the lecturer was explaining how, you know, there's this sort of myth that British film is stuffy and old-fashioned and kitchen sink dramas, or it's like cheap rom-coms that get sold to America very easily. And then they showed us some Matter of Life and Death. And it was really like, you know, scales falling from my eyes. I was just like bowled away that a film this sort of ambitious and visually daring and romantic and exciting and, you know, conceptual could be made in the British film industry and in the 1940s as well, while there was a war on. And it was just like mind-blowing to me. And that's still my favourite of their films. I think it's probably my favourite film of all time.
You've written an Empire masterpiece about that.
I have, yeah. I'm obsessed with it. So yeah, that's where the love affair began for me, I would say.
Amazing.
I think it might have been through Empire that I first read about them. It took me a shameful amount of time to actually see one of their films in full, but I remember seeing clips, I think, for the Scorsese documentary and other things. And just the colours and the energy. But the first couple I saw were The Red Shoes and Black Narcissus, and I was really bowled over. And it took me quite a while to get to The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which is now my favourite. And that film, every time I see it, I get something different out of
really?
It.
Really? Why is that one?
I just find it fascinating. I love what they do with Deborah Carr playing multiple characters. I love Roger Livesey's performance in it. I love the colour, just the strangeness of it. It doesn't hew to any kind of formula. It doesn't feel like any other film. And it's so kind of strange and unique that, yeah, I just think it's endlessly rewatchable.
There's also that theory that the pair of them are kind of counterparts of Powell and Pressburger. You can get the sense of that friendship.
Yeah, it's a great movie about friendship, and yeah, especially that one of the characters is German and the other is British, and they made it during the war. And yeah, it's such a warm kind of, you know, interesting dynamic between the two of them.
I think John's point is interesting though about how they were perceived within British film, in that especially before Scorsese got involved, their reputation was really low. I think for a couple of reasons. Peeping Tom was reviled by the British critics.
Yeah. And that was Powell on his own, wasn't it? That wasn't...
Yeah, just Powell on his own.
Yeah.
And also I think there was a sense that after those young, sort of working class, young angry men films, there was a sense that they were perceived as creaky films, old-fashioned, Yeah. So they really had fallen out of favor, and it for a large part it did take Scorsese and his ilk to build them up again. There's a lovely story about George Romero,
yes,
who loved the Tales of Hoffman, and he used to take the Tales of Hoffman out of a film library every week. And one week he went there and it wasn't there, and Scorsese had it.
Oh,
that's cool, isn't it? How great is that?
He should have got the box set.
He told me that story. I was lucky enough to hear that story Romero himself. And basically he wanted to rent the Tales of Hoffman, and every time he went to rent it, he couldn't rent it because some other kid had it. And eventually he was like, well, who is this kid who is renting out the fucking Tales of Hoffman? And he asked the people, and GDPR didn't exist back then, so they just went, oh, it's this kid from Brooklyn or Queens or something, name's Martin Scorsese. So he tracked him down, and they had a big fight
yeah,
and Romero has zombies on his side but Scorsese has Joe Pesci, so it was a draw in the end.
But that's interesting, Ian, about the creaky thing, because looking at them now, they feel timeless to me. Like, they don't feel dated. And I think there's something so interesting, the choices they make over and over again are so bold that I think they've really, that's why they've endured. It doesn't feel like there's they're formulaic at all.
Yeah. I mean, they were made, you know, in a very specific time. You know, a lot of them are, they're sort of, you know, big creative spurt was just sort of the 1940s and 50s. And a lot of them were made partly, I guess, with the cooperation of like the British government. I think there was, you know, elements of propaganda. I know Matter of Life and Death was made partly to improve Anglo-American relations. And I Know Where I'm Going was made they wanted to encourage less materialism and that sort of thing. And
promoting Anglo-Scottish relations.
Anglo-Scottish relations, yeah. But you know, they sort of move past that sort of basic propaganda. It becomes much more, I don't know, the themes become a bit deeper in their hands somehow. Like,
yeah. I think right from the start, 49th Parallel was kind of a propaganda film, or it was designed to be one, and One of Our Aircraft is Missing. Love that title.
Yeah.
No relation to One of Our Dinosaurs is Missing. But they did really interesting things, and 49th Parallel, I only saw quite recently, but I love it. You know, it's a war story from the point of view of the Nazis. Such a big swing, and it's a brilliant film.
Has this BFI retrospective, has it made you, I don't know, not clock back into them, because I know you're a big fan and always have been, but you know, have you been specifically seeking out stuff that you haven't seen? And there's stuff on the big screen now, I guess, that people won't have seen for a while during this retrospective. Obviously, there's the classics, The Red Shoes and Matter of Life and Death, but there must be smaller films. I imagine not a lot of people have seen things like I Know Where I'm Going or Il Met by Moonlight.
That one I hadn't seen A Canterbury Tale before. Okay. I watched that a couple of weeks ago, and that's a strange film. It's
So it's an updating of
the Chaucer.
Into the Second World War.
And it's sort of partly a mystery about, it's kind of these three characters, who I guess are the pilgrims, and follows them. And there's also a mystery around the bloke who's pouring glue onto women's heads for some reason called the Glue Man. And that's quite a big part of the film. And it's very strange, but it's a really beautiful ending when you kind of see what happens to all the characters. And I think that was pretty unpopular when it came out, as I recall. Like, people didn't really warm to it.
Like Alien Autopsy, in fairness. It's taken a long time for people to warm to the charms of that particular movie.
Yeah, but it's a really interesting film, I think. It's peculiar.
Yeah. There's one film called Gone to Earth, which I have yet to see, but I think it's getting like a new Blu-ray restoration release or something with this season. And that is a really interesting little sort of kind of footnote on their career, because it was, I think it was re-edited by David Selznick, the American producer.
It's their first sort of foray into Hollywood filmmaking.
Right.
And it went belly up. But it's really interesting. Jennifer Jones is in it. It's kind of this mystical kind of her relationship, the affinity with the land. It's kind of a strange little thing. Yeah,
was she like married to David Selznick or something?
Yeah,
am I remembering that right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's all filmed in like the Shropshire countryside, right? Which is, you know, very, it's got a sort of English folk.
But visually it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
The colours are so rich.
Yeah, I need to watch that one.
They were an interesting partnership as well, weren't they? So I think you could say that they were broken down into the traditional filmmaking roles. Powell was the director and Pressburger was the producer, but they were presented as Powell and Pressburger films. They had this filmmaking team around them, didn't they, of regular contributors and collaborators that they called the Archers, no relation to the Radio 4 farming soap opera, or is it? I don't know. Maybe it is. But that was an unusual way to present themselves creatively, wasn't it? That it was this partnership. It was this cabal.
Yeah.
So a little bit pre Coen Brothers, I guess.
Pressburger wrote, and Powell directed, but they are.
Pressburger came up with most of the ideas, I think. I think that's right. Michael Powell, if you haven't read Michael Powell's book, A Life in Movies, I think it's called. Yeah. And then there's a sequel to it, Million Dollar Film, I think it's called. But it's an amazing book, which goes up to Black Narcissus, and it's really, really great.
Yeah. And there's also a sense that everybody talks about Powell and Pressburger. But as Chris says, there is this huge team of the best craftsmen and craftswomen in the industry at the time. And so just shouting out them feels a bit wrong. It's like, obviously, the cinematographers, Jack Cardiff, and production designers, Hein Hengeroff. Mm. So there's a lot of people behind the magic.
Yeah, and they work with the same actors over and again, Roger Livesey and Deborah Carr, obviously.
Yeah.
So they have their little ensemble.
Yeah, Rubbishy Company.
Mm. And I think the having that collaboration of the two of them, I think, lends itself really well to their films. You know, Emmerich Pressburger was like a Hungarian Jew who, you know, escaped the Nazis. And he has that perspective that you feel in all of these films, especially in something like Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, where there's this sort of very humane, right at the height of the war, there's this like very humanistic like approach to things where you could be very bitter and angry about the state of the world, and instead you approach it with love and with sort of
I also think that Peeping Tom wouldn't have happened with Emmerich Pressburger. So I just think he doesn't have that sensibility. It would have been a much different film if Emmerich Pressburger had been involved.
Exactly. I think Pressburger was maybe slightly more romantic and more optimistic than Powell. But they sort of counterbalanced each other's sensibilities.
But there is that really interesting thing of them making what seem like very British films, but kind of one of them is a real outsider, or both in a way are kind of outsiders. And so, you know, they got in trouble with the British government and Churchill when Colonel Blimp came out because it wasn't patriotic enough. Just showing the friendship between a German and a British guy at that point where the war was still going on was really kind of radical.
Yeah, there's something about Pressburger being an immigrant, and I think trying very hard to integrate and to become British. You know, you see that in A Matter of Life and Death, which is almost like, you know, it's like Britishness or Englishness is put on trial kind of thing. That's almost like Pressburger, like coming to terms with his own identity.
Yeah, I think the first 5 minutes of that film are as good as any first 5 minutes of any film.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful. So, David Niven is a pilot coming to land his film and he can't land. He knows he's going to die. He talks to an American radio comms woman and they just have this lovely exchange for 5 minutes. It will break your heart. It's terrific. It's so great.
It's like flirting at the end of his life, isn't it? And he says, I think there's a line where he says something like, "Your life and I'm leaving it." You know, it's like, it's so bittersweet. It's beautiful. And also the opening line of that film, "This is the universe, big, isn't it?" Which is just
it begins in the universe. It's like it's a wonderful life.
It
begins in the heavens, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it ends up there. Yeah, and such a great idea to switch Earth to being color, heaven to being black and white, which is the opposite of what we'd see. You know, any kind of depictions of heaven.
Yeah,
so reverse Wizard of Oz. That's called.
So Pressburger did the writing.
Yeah.
Powell did the pacing and everything else. Yeah, and I know you had the good fortune in your career to talk to Jack Cardiff.
I did, years ago.
Oh, wow.
About 20 odd years ago now.
Yeah.
And just a fantastic filmmaker, a great man. And if you think of something like Black Narcissus, which is entirely studio bound, and the visuals of that film are astonishing. These films also they also feel handcrafted in a way.
The matte paintings and
The matte paintings are photographs painted with hand painted, so they have that unique feel about them.
There's a great photo of Jack Cardiff on the set of Red Shoes with one of the cameras, and the camera is absolutely huge. You kind of forget like how giant like the equipment was as well, and it's such a nimble kind of, so much energy, and the camera work is so kind of spry and quick in that film. It's amazing.
And he introduced that kind of changing the film speeds down for the ballet sequences that Scorsese absolutely rips off for Racing Bulls. Absolutely admits it. He absolutely ripped that from them. There's that lovely moment in A Matter of Life and Death where you get a kind of a transition, and it's it's Powell breathing on the lens of the camera. It all fogs up.
Oh, brilliant.
And comes out again. It's lovely stuff. It's
when the camera's great. Spinning in the red shoes. Yeah. I love that Jack Cardiff shot Black Narcissus in red shoes and then did Rambo 2. during which Stallone went over to him and told him his lighting was wrong at one point. And according to Jack Cardiff in his book, they almost got in a fist fight in the middle of the jungle. But
Who would your money be on? Unless he's Jack Cardiff. I'm going for Sly in that one.
Not if he's got Thelma for backup.
There's a great documentary about Jack Cardiff. I think it's called Just Cameraman, which that really like turned me on to his work, and that it really shows. He was really influenced by like traditional art. He would like refer to paintings, and you really get a sense of that in their films, especially the ones that he was working on. There's this sort of painterly quality, and the colors are just so like vibrant and. Yeah,
especially in Black Narcissus, there's something so strange and powerful about that film. You know, it's a psychodrama, but the visually, I always just think of the lipstick shot and the shot with the bell, and just the use of color in that film is absolutely astonishing.
So, how much of that came from Cardiff, and how much of that came from Michael Powell? I mean, in terms of the visual side of things, if Pressburger is doing the writing, what is Powell bringing to this partnership?
Powell is bringing that because if you look at the other films. That Cardiff didn't shoot, that sensibility is still there. So you kind of think that visual sense and the sense of the fantastical and the kind of the indelible imagery does come from Powell. I'm not to dismiss what Jack Cardiff did, but
of course,
that seems to be proved throughout the whole of the work.
All right, well let's start wrapping this bad boy up now, and let's talk about favorite moments. I mean, John, you've already said your favorite movie is Matter of Life and Death. Nick, your favorite movie is Black Narcissus?
I can never choose. I Colonel Blimp, I've got a real soft spot for, but yeah. Black Narcissus and Red Shoes, I keep going back to over and over. So, depending on the given day, one of those three.
All right. Ian, favorite movie?
Alien Autopsy. I can't. How can you choose? You can't choose.
Yeah, you got to choose. You got to choose.
I'll choose a moment.
Imagine we were doing a ranking.
If I was doing a ranking, I would choose Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. Just for the friendship at the heart of it, which I think is beautiful.
Oh, that's two for one. But either way, Life and Death is in the title of whatever you've gone for.
So technically a comic book movie, by the way, Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. So,
really?
You know, yeah, it was based on a comic book.
That sound you can hear is Martin Scorsese disowning it.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not cinema.
He's furious now.
But yeah, Colonel Blimp, the way it starts is this kind of like pumped up comedy and it ends as something really melancholy, and it's got such depth to it, and it starts with such a ridiculous character in the middle of it, but it becomes beautiful and really, you know.
Is there about a bit of cinema in any of their films in the 17 minutes of the Red Shoes that is the ballet?
That's
as good as it gets, isn't
that's,
it?
That, if you're talking about best moments, that is probably up there. I mean, and watching that on a big screen as well is like something akin to a religious experience. It's quite amazing.
I would argue that 17 minutes is too long to be a moment. So my moment, I'm going to pick my greatest moment as, I'm going to pick two, from Black Narcissus. One where Kathleen Byron opens the door and Kathleen Byron's standing there with her stunning red lipstick. Then later on in the film, she's got wild hair and she's walking toward the camera and the camera tracks back. And that's just amazing filmmaking. That's astonishing. We always talk about the visuals, but they are great with actors. They are so good. There's this, a lot of the actors' best performances are in Powell and Pressburger films. David Niven's never been as good as in Matter of Life and Death. And, you know, they're brilliant with actors. Nick, what's your favourite moment from the...
It's probably, well, it's either the ending of The Red Shoes that's just knocks me out every time I see it. It's such a crazy way to end the film. And it's just, you know, a movie about the power of art. And, you know, it's a tragedy, but you kind of watch it and forget it's just how powerful and strong that moment is. Or the end of Black, I think they're really great endings. The Black Narcissus ending, again, with, like, as you said, Sister Ruth, Catherine Byron just is brilliant. And the moment where she flips out is incredible.
John, have you done a moment?
Well, I think it's already been covered, really. I think the opening of A Matter of Life and Death, the first 5 minutes, I don't think anything tops that for me.
And they're very influential, aren't they? I'm not sure if it was on record, but I'm pretty sure we talked about Soul, for example, with Thelma and Kevin. Yeah. I was in the room pressing record. John was the one who was doing the
Soul,
talking.
The Pixar film.
Yeah, Pixar film. And, because obviously it has also a Stairway to Heaven.
Black Swan. Would that exist without the Red Shoes?
Yep.
I think there's even some camera stuff in that that's kind of referencing Red Shoes directly. But there's tons, and the spirit of them, I think, as well.
Yeah, I think you can look at Barbie, and I think it's very difficult to imagine Barbie without those kind of fantastical sets and that sense of the artifice being very apparent.
Mm.
I think
that comes from, and also next year, Yorgos Lanthimos's Poor Things.
Oh yeah,
is very, very ripped from Palin Pressburger. When she goes on a world trip, and there's all the countries there are kind of very fake and artificial, and that feels very Palin Pressburger to me.
They are like filmmakers in a way, aren't they? Like Greta Gerwig has specifically cited, I think, Red Shoes as being a big Barbie influence. And Scorsese is the world's biggest Palin Pressburger fan, and you see constantly references in his films. I mean, Thelma Schoonmaker was saying, she did a talk at the BFI, and she was saying how Tales of Hoffman, which was written to the music, I mean, it was filmed specifically to match the musical cues of this opera. And Scorsese just borrowed that technique constantly, like the Layla scene in Goodfellas. The sequence there was written for that song. It was like planned out for those musical beats, and that's direct influence from Tales of Hoffman.
I think it's interesting is that Gerwig and Lanthimos are two generations on from Scorsese.
Yeah,
so it's still that the influence is still percolating down, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, and I think the BFI season that is happening at the moment, it seems to be completely sold out. And the screening I went to see, I Know Where I'm Going, last week, and it was like every generation was there. I think young people seem to be, I'm not sure I can quite call myself a young person anymore, but
young adjacent,
recently young. I think they are, like you say, Nick, they're timeless films. And I think they keep getting rediscovered. Mm. And that's really lovely to see.
My favorite bit in that is the train at the beginning.
Yes.
There's a model train that goes through Scotland and the landscape is a very kind of, it's kind of flags, isn't it?
Yeah.
So great.
I'm sure there's a terrible rom-com, modern rom-com with the same plot as I Know Where I'm Going, Talking Influences, set in Scotland.
Really?
I think so. I can't remember who's in it. I know I'm seeing The Red Shoes and Colonel Blimp on the big screen for the first time, both of those. So I can't wait to see that. And with a sold out audience, how great is that?
Brilliant. Amazing.
Well, there we go. A good note on which to end, I think. That is it for this very special podcast dedicated to the work of Palin Pressburger with special guests, Thelma Schoonmaker and Kevin MacDonald. And it is Schoonmaker. We checked with her. Or rather, she corrected us. One of the two.
Oh boy.
But it is now, because for years I've said Schoon. But the boat's the Schoon, so you would say, so it makes sense.
Maka? Schoonmaker?
She said Maker.
Maker.
She says Schoonmaker. Sorry, Thelma. And now we just have to send this podcast to her and she's going to edit it in her spare time.
It'll be two seconds long.
She'll win an Academy Award for it.
That's the only way any of us are getting near an Academy Award. All right. Okay. All that remains now is for me to say goodbye to my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Ian Freer.
I'm off to steal the Red Shoes.
please don't, Ian. Please don't get arrested. John Nugent.
Goodbye. I know where I'm going, and it's out of this podcast studio.
There are no more I know where I'm going jokes. It's obvious, and it's first base. Nick DeSemelian, goodbye.
I was going to make an I know where I'm going joke, but I'm just going to go and have lunch and turn myself into a blimp. It's like the word blimp. It's a great word.
Bill Shankly once said, football is not just a matter of life and death. It's much more important than that.
Yes.
And I think he was also thinking about this podcast. In many, many ways.
Likely.
Yeah. It's goodbye from me as well. I know where I'm going, and it's to direct you guys towards the BFI website so you can find out more information about Cinema Unbound, the creative worlds of Powell and Pressburger. It's bfi.org.uk, and you can book tickets for whatever screenings and talks that there are still seats available for. There ain't many. Let's put it that way. But thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.